there is absolutely no better time to buy an RV than right now.
How do you see the industry shaking out, particularly in terms of EV?
The campsite pedestals will have meters on them, so you will be charged for the amount of power that you use. Big corporate money into the campground sector.
In this episode of RVing with Joe and Kate, we're talking to Rick Kessler from RV Business. He's going to get into the 2024 trends of the RV industry, their pick for RV of the year, and he's going to explain why now is the best time to buy an RV. Let's get right into it. Rick, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on this with you.
So to give our audience a little backstory, the three of us have known each other almost since we started RVing. You've had over 10 years in the RVing industry. We're looking to find out like some of the trends that are coming up in RV business. Y'all just announced the 2024 RV of the year. But before we get into that, tell our audience a bit about yourself and what it is you do in the RV industry.
And how you got into RVing.
Since February, so almost a year now, myself and my business partner, Scott Stropke, we've been the owners of G&G Media. G&G Media is our business that publishes RV Business Magazine, as well as Woodall's Campground Magazine. That's for the campground side of the industry. Before that, I worked at RV Business for about 8 years, 9 years, editorial functions. And even before that, you know, you asked about when I first got into RVing. I guess I grew up in it. One set of grandparents had Class A motorhomes going all the way back to the 70s. They had, remember the Robin Williams, the big green turd?
Oh, yeah. Little shag carpeting.
That's what they had. They had a Superior was the model, the brand. Just a big green box really is what it was on a chassis. They started that in the 70s and... gosh, they've had a Holiday Rambler. They had a Four Travel. They went as far south as the Panama Canal and as far north as way up into Alaska. My parents are RVers. I've got, maybe four sets of aunts and uncles that are RVers. And we just grew up with it. So we continued on. And I like to tell this story. The first year that we had our RV was 2007. It was built in 2000. So it was a Trail Light Bantam, one of the very first hybrids that ever came out. And yes, we had water leaks all over the place. I replaced the floor twice because it was so bad. But I remember that first summer we had our kids were young and they were still with us. And my middle, Luke, our son, says to me, he says, "Dad, don't ever get rid of this." I'm like, "Okay, why?" And he says, "Because when I get older, I'm going to get one and we'll go camping together." I was like, "Oh, perfect. That's what I love."
Things have come a long way since the Bantam. So let's kind of get into the 2024 RV of the year through RV Business.
We selected for the RV of the year, the RV Suite, and it's the Ibex and the No Boundaries brands both have an RV Suite model, and that's from Forest River. We selected it because it's truly changes the design standard, I guess, than what we've been seeing normally. I mean, everybody knows what a travel trailer looks like, a fifth wheel looks like. They really all kind of, I hate to say it, but they all kind of look the same after a while, especially if you've been into the same, you know, hundreds of them within the course of a week, which is what we do at Open House. Open House, by the way, that's in the end of September. That's for the industry only, where the manufacturers put all of their units out on display for the dealers to come and look at them and hopefully make all of their orders for the coming year. The RV Suite, how do you describe it, right? To me, when I first saw it, it looked like a caboose.
I agree. When I looked at those pictures, like especially that back portion with the porch and the overhang, yeah.
It's boxy, almost like a destination trailer or a downsized park model RV. But the reason why it's boxy like that is because without that forward angled aerodynamic cap, you're able to use a lot more interior space. And that's where they put, at least the model on display, that's where they put this pretty big bathroom. Honestly, the bathroom is inside is a lot bigger than what you would expect when you look at that particular unit. That's probably the best way to describe it. The first third is the bathroom. The middle third is the living kitchen area. And the back third is the bedroom slash flex room, because the bed is a Murphy bed. So when it's out of the way, huge, massive table for not only for eating, but I mean, you could set up a home office in there pretty easily. And even then the table flips out of the way. So you got this big, huge, basically garage, if you wanted it to be a garage. Like you said, Joe, off the back end is that it's, I think it's a 4 foot patio is what they're calling it now. It was 3 foot at the show, but they added an extra foot. Perfect for gear storage, bikes, generator, whatever it is you don't want inside, you can put there when you're traveling. But then when you're set up at camp, I mean, gosh, if you're overlooking a lake and coffee in the morning or a cocktail at sunset, that's a pretty good spot.
I'm in. I like it.
Well, yeah, it's coffee. Of course you're in.
Yeah. And I think, speaking of which, when we were looking through the other kind of 10 runners up, my favorite out of that whole group was the InTech. It's a toy hauler, a large toy hauler, I think GVWR of around 6,000 pounds. And I've been looking for something to carry the motorcycle around behind the van. So that's up there. I like those InTechs. And then the hilt was in there by Storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which we've had a brief chance to take a look at. In doing your evaluation for the RV of the year, what were you all looking for? And did you notice any trends with this year's finalists?
It's a beauty contest. I mean, there's no wrong answer. There's no right answer. We, like I said, at this open house, there's quite literally maybe as many as 5,000 units out on display. Okay. Nobody really knows for sure, but the OEMs put everything they make out on display. So it's a massive, massive lineup. Myself and my team, and it's about a dozen of us, we basically fan out. We make sure that we see every manufacturer. And when we're there, we say to that manufacturer, show us your RV of the year, you know, give us your top two or three contenders that you think we ought to be looking at. And they do, and we look at them. And when we're looking at them, it's always going to be what's different, what's new, what's unique, what's not cookie cutter, what is not, you know, the industry joke is, what does R&D stand for? Replicate and duplicate. So anything new, anything unique, anything that's innovative, and it's not necessarily the design, but maybe some of the components or technology. For example, going back to the RV suite, they partnered up with WFCO, WFCO, for one of their control systems called Power Pro, and it's voice activated, and it's, you know, it's like having Alexa in your RV. It's pretty cool. The other thing that we look for is how might this perform in the market? Because if we were going to just pick something based on looks and function, the $2 million Prevo would win every year. We can't really do that. So something that just looks great, but is probably not going to sell very many. Okay, we got to take that into consideration. Another reason why the RV suite was our winner is because it's still, yes, it's a little bit expensive compared to a lot of the travel trailers out there, but at about 50 grand, it's not that far of a stretch for many people. The other thing that we look for, you know, it's got to pass the eye test. I mean, if it looks cool, if it looks sexy, if it's got the nice color combination, the good no more paisley stripes, that's for sure. We gather at the end of the week. We talk about what we saw. Then we make sure that we'll get a, I don't know, 20 or so contenders. All of us will go to every one of those just so that we all can talk from the same benchmark. And then, honestly, after that, it's a pretty good debate. We just kind of hammer it out and end up with a winner.
And I will say, to attest to how busy you and your team were, when we saw you at the open house, you were going this way, we were going that way, and it was like, hi, bye, got to get going.
You were a man on a mission.
Yes.
Going back to that voice-activated feature on the RV suite, I thought that was really interesting. I think the example that you all had in the RV Business article was you can say, hey, I'm home, and it turns on the interior lights. And that's a pretty cool feature, and I don't think many RVs have that integrated today.
It'll happen soon enough. I mean, you know, that's typically how it works, right? Somebody gets it and then everybody either picks up the same thing or the competitors will pick up and replicate and duplicate. I think it starts out with, it comes with 50 preset voice activated commands. I think one of the things that he said was you can even if you're not there, you can jump on your phone and send a message or a command to your RV suite. And you're going to be, maybe you're out hiking and it's 90 degrees. Well, you can tell your RV suite, I'm coming home in 10 minutes, get the temperature down. I don't know if it'll open the fridge and get the beer out for you yet, but it, you know, that's next, I guess.
Let's put it on the R&D for next year. speaking of next year, I think this is a good time to kind of get into where you see things going in 2024 and beyond. But at the same time, I'd kind of like you to go backwards a little bit, because since 2020, we've had an unprecedented type of RV market. Mm-hmm. And you've been involved in the RV industry long enough to have seen the ups and downs. And could you kind of talk our audience through what it is that's happened in the last few years leading up to this point, and then what we have to look forward to in 2024 and beyond?
Sure. No surprise, COVID really kickstarted the RV industry. It's been well documented, so I won't dwell on it too much. But basically what happened was, we were all sequestered into our homes and we couldn't go anywhere. And the only outlet for recreation seemed to be going outside and enjoying national parks and the trails and everything else. And unless you are sincerely intent on sleeping on the ground in a tent, which is fine, it's just some of us don't care to do that anymore. But RVs was a great way to be self-contained and get out there and enjoy the great outdoors while we were under the COVID restrictions. So the RV industry went from normal, making 400,000 or so units per year. COVID hit and the industry was shut down like everybody else was shut down. There was some back channel efforts made to make the RV industry quote unquote essential. So that allowed them to open up. And when it did, that's when the consumer demand, the retail demand, really kicked into high gear. So the industry went from normal to zero to well beyond normal production within the space of a month. It was that quick. Millions, I think it was something like 1.2 million units were sold in the two-year time right after COVID was allowed to, they were allowed to resume production after once COVID hit. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that 1.2 million, a lot of that were future customers, what's called pull through. So the people that might have been thinking about buying a unit in 2022 or 2023 or even next year, they said, well, let's get one now because this is when we can best use it and enjoy it. So a lot of those customers came early on, and because of that, the industry is now in a lull. A soft market is the best, most positive way to put it, but it's definitely in a lull. Let's see, 2 years ago, the 600,000 units were made. This year, we're probably looking at about 300,000, so half the market, right? When is that going to let up? When are we going to re-emerge into a normal market? My crystal ball's not that good. The people we talk to, the ones who do know what they're talking about, matter of fact, Wells Fargo, I just finished editing a story from them on their economic forecast, and they basically say more of the same at best. They always put in the caveat, you know, barring any unforeseen circumstance like another war or something like that. But just given the present conditions, they're looking at roughly the end of 2024 to the early part of 2025 before the economy returns to such a point where people are going to start buying those big ticket items again, like an RV.
In thinking about that from the consumer's perspective, you know, I'm shopping for an RV. With the lull in the industry that's happening, how does that impact the quality and the availability of RVs for people who are shopping?
Oh, honestly, there is absolutely no better time to buy an RV than right now. Maybe even it might be a little bit past the best time, because the RV dealers, remember back in 2021 when they were selling 600,000, they couldn't get an RV fast enough. The manufacturers couldn't build them fast enough. To your point about quality, yeah, I mean, that's going to affect quality, because you can't build something that involved on such a fast track and not have issues. Just, it's not an acceptable answer, but it is the answer. I mean, that is the answer. To your point, those dealers overordered and are now sitting on excess inventory. And they are about to be hit with some all kinds of floor plan interest rates. Floor plan is what they, that's the term for when they buy these units from the OEMs, they have to go through a lender, just like we have to go through a lender to buy an RV, right? Well, they have to go through a lender, and those lenders now are needing to get paid for all of those interest rates that the dealers are sitting on, especially as they come up on winter months when it most, you know, the top half of the country shuts down. So if you want a 2020, if you want a brand new RV, you can literally go to a dealer, go to their website, find a 2022 brand new RV that's been sitting on their lot for a couple of years. The dealer doesn't want it anymore. They want to sell it. They got to make room for the 2024s coming in. I can tell you how many, probably half the dealers I know that I've talked with, and that we're talking well over 100 or so, they're selling those 2022s below their invoice. They're getting rid of them, and it's a brand new unit. This is the best time to buy.
And if my understanding is correct, the reason they're doing that is that because they're still paying interest on it, it's taking up room on their lot, and it's better for them to get rid of it at a loss rather than hold it.
That is correct. The other thing, and this is getting way down into the weeds, but some of those lenders have fine print where after a certain amount of time, that interest rate that they're going to charge will increase because basically time has expired. That 2022, on paper, they won't consider that a new unit anymore. It'll be considered a used unit, even though it's never been sold. The other reason, you're talking about the floor plan interest rates. You know how our interest rates have gone up. If we wanted to buy a car, it's, you know, tripled. It's the same situation with these dealers. They were paying the 3% interest rates. Now they're up in 9, 10, or even more, depending on who they're with. That loss is growing incrementally.
If a consumer walks into a dealership, and we'll use round numbers to keep it easy, and the MSRP of an RV is $100,000, can you shed some light on if they're sitting down and negotiate or should start to think about where they can buy that RV? What should they consider with that MSRP price, and how far do you think they could get that down?
Okay. Yeah. And in a normal situation, you know, let's take the 2022 years, the model years out of it, just a normal situation. My rule of thumb has always been one third, 33%, 100,000. So 66,000, that's what I want to buy it at. Very, very general rule of thumb, because every dealer is purchasing those units at a price that they negotiate. So they're going to be up and down that 33%. But across the board, that's probably the best case scenario that I can give you.
Yeah, and my assumption then too is if it's a unit that's in high demand, you're not going to get that 33%.
We were at that Florida RV show, Super Show together, looking at the prices at 2021 and 2022. They were getting and demanding prices over MSRP.
That was a wild few years.
It was. I was so used to going shopping, looking at a price and saying, yeah, you know, 20-30% off of this, that makes sense. And then you see the MSRP, and then you see the dealer is marking it up well above that, and people are buying it.
But it sounds like we're coming back down to the more realistic expectations for what we can pay for a new RV.
It's kind of like when the snowstorm is coming, everybody goes out and buys milk. Well, I guess, you know, COVID is coming, let's go out and buy an RV. And price gouging took effect.
Yeah. And what do you think of the used market? How is that going to look?
That's going to be interesting, because there has always been this talk, I guess, or even a concern in the industry that all of these COVID buyers were going to be done with their RV because it wasn't what they were expecting. And I mean, there's a whole nother conversation about what those expectations were and why they weren't being met. But the worry was that they were going to flood the used market. And yes, there is an uptick in used RVs, but not nearly to the extent people were concerned about. And it's just like a car, right? You buy a used so that somebody else takes that first hit on the depreciation. And then in an RV's case, that first buyer, the first owner, they're the ones that work out the bugs. And in my case, you know, fix the floor twice because of water leaks. I've always suggested to my friends and family to go through the used market first. But with a brand new one selling for less than some of these used ones, it's hard to say no to that.
Now, I want to go kind of back to the RV of the year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now that we're looking forward, in looking through the top 10 runners up you had, I was surprised to see, I mean, a lot of tow behinds. You had mm-hmm. a couple motorized units, but then you had the GXV Hilt. It's a large overlanding vehicle costing upwards of $400,000 with pretty much every bell and whistle on it that you can think of. With a vehicle like that, do you see more of those entering the space? How do you see that kind of overlanding space permeating the RV industry, which to me has always been more like the traditional motorhome or tow behind?
Joe, your question couldn't be timed better. Our cover story for the Jan-Feb issue is on how the overlanding segment has made some pretty good inroads into what we're calling mainstream RVing. And yeah, the storyteller is a great example of that. And that's one of the reasons why it was one of our finalists is just, yes, it's $400,000, but it's pretty dang sexy. it just oozes testosterone all over the place. I remember walking into that unit and Trent Tiffin was sitting in the corner and he just said, "Hey, Rick, what do you," you know, the Alabama drawl. He says, "Hey, Rick, so what do you think?" And I was like, "Holy cow, man, I love it. I don't know if I'll ever get in one and drive it, but it looks awesome." But to answer your question, overlanding, yeah. And it's motorized like the Hilt. It's, let's see, Dynamax came out with one, and I'm going to miss a few because just about anybody that builds on that 4x4 Sprinter van has something that more or less could be considered an overland type of a unit. And that's what we're talking about in our story is as these mainstream OEMs, Thor and Forest River and Winnebago and their subsidiaries, as they explore this overland segment, they're going to go to one level or another. I mean, somebody might go all out like the Ember RV with the independent suspension and the articulated hitch and the recovery boards and the full-on solar and lithium. Then you got the other extreme of that exploration, which is we put knobby tires on. Okay, that doesn't count. That's not overlanding. That's what we're seeing, though, and that's... we focused on this particular article coming out on just the towables, just because it's much easier entry point for most of these manufacturers to get into. And it's the mainstream RV makers that are capturing it's capturing their attention, and they're starting to explore it. That's probably the best way to describe it. You still have all of those places out west, especially Colorado and Utah and California, where they're making awesome looking teardrops basically in their garage. Mod Buggy is a one example of that. They're actually just north of Elkhart, just inside Southwest Michigan. It's a teardrop with the tent camper on top of it. Awesome looking unit. And that was also one of our top 10 finalists.
A lot of these OEMs getting into the overlanding space, is it just because it's the next thing? It looks cool. People are infatuated. I'm curious to find out or understand the reasoning behind the decision to go into that market.
Good question. And I've got a cynical answer. How many of those buyers do you think will actually use that rig in a true overlanding environment?
I would say very few. Probably the same number of people who buy an F-150 to use it as a work truck.
If I'm Joe Consumer, I love how it looks. It makes me feel good when I'm driving it or I'm pulling it. So I don't care if it never gets off pavement, I just like it. That's probably why these mainstream RV makers are heading in that direction, because why buy the Chevette when the Corvette looks prettier?
I think in our own journey of overlanding, we took our stuff off-road. We, you know, put it to the test and everything else. We just got tired of the fact that every time we would go on an overlanding trip, we'd get back and something would have to be fixed.
There was always something. We would end up at the shop, or Joe at some auto repair shop parking lot fixing something.
Uh-huh. Well, what I'm curious about is, like, the GXV Hilt, for example, they're running full, I think it's 40-inch military off-road tires, and they're very specific. And if you are a normal RVer and you're not really using that and those tires for what they're meant to do,
yeah,
what happens when you go into a tire center and you need to get new tires put on?
You don't think Les Schwab carries those?
No, probably not. Although I'm sure they can get them. It just... there's going to be a lot more complexities, I think, to a vehicle like that that people don't necessarily understand right off the bat. I think there are going to be a lot of people out there who appreciate those things, and those who do understand it will put them to full use. But it is an awesome vehicle, and I'm at some point hoping Storyteller Overland lets us take it out for a couple of weeks to actually play with it. But I will say, after, you know, we started with our Class A motorhome. Mm-hmm. And after going down to the van and the truck camper, I think it would be hard for us to go back to a vehicle of that size. Because if I remember correctly, the Hilt is 28 feet. Our Class A motorhome was 29. Mm. So, you know, we're back to a point where we may need to start towing a car again. We are going to have to be cautious about the gas stations, the parking lots, and things you go into. It's an awesome vehicle. I don't know or think we would use it to its potential.
Do you guys ever consider going the towable route?
We do. So we've looked at things like the InTech. That was one of the things I was really interested in when we were going through Elkhart, was some of the companies and the toy haulers that they're doing. Mm-hmm. What's also interesting is I've noticed a trend of companies that had toy haulers have started to move away from them, at least the smaller ones, where other companies are coming out with them. But I've been really interested in something small that can tow a motorcycle, but also have sleeping quarters and, you know, a battery system, some of the amenities that you get in an RV. And we've talked about doing that. We've also talked about doing a bigger towable, because that's the one type of RV we've never used.
And you've been towing since you all started RVing, right? Because you and Angie started with a truck and trailer, and you all still have a truck and trailer.
Just a small correction. We started out with a minivan and a trailer. do not recommend that. It works for us because we live in Michigan, and oh gosh, the elevation change is the on-ramp. I mean, that's about it. But it worked for us for a couple of years. Then we switched it up to a large SUV, and then More recently, yeah, we do have a truck.
So what are we missing by not having a towable?
One of the reasons why we like it is wherever we're at, we just unhitch and we've got a personal vehicle to go, where, you know, to the restaurant or to the trailhead or whatever, you know. That's one reason. I think the other reason is, especially when we had the kids with us, we could get, we could sleep all three kids in their own bed plus us in our own bed in that 22-foot hybrid travel trailer. It worked out for us. You just got a lot more bang for your buck with the travel trailer and the fifth wheel too, for that matter. And it's not really a negative, because motorhomes are nice, but the negative with that is the mileage, just the how much gas you have to put into those things. I mean, the truck isn't great. I'm getting about 8 miles a gallon when I'm pulling. I'm getting about 20 when I'm not. It is still better than a Class A, though.
I remember having to fill that 80-gallon tank. That just hurt when you look at the gas meter.
But, I mean, if you're bringing your motorcycle with you, like you're talking about, I mean, you can't get any better mileage than that.
No. The motorcycle would be, I think, more for fun. It's really, like, we want to go places where we can take the motorcycle and have it with us where I'm not riding it to the destination.
Sure.
Because we did a trip earlier this year, or we did a trip in, was it October, September, where we drove the van and I followed in the motorcycle. Well, technically Kate followed. But we went down to Alabama, went up to Chattanooga, and kind of came around. And that was a lot on the motorcycle be sitting on the highway. Because at that point, I was trying to get from point A to point B, not see all the little places in between.
Part of the fun of traveling is being in the same vehicle with your spouse or your partner or your friend or whatever, and just enjoying that. I'm sure you probably had some sort of a walkie-talkie setup or microphone setup, but it's just not the same.
No, it isn't. And you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the fun for us is the two of us sitting there going down the road together. Whoever is driving, the other one can grab them a snack, something to drink.
Yeah.
We recently got a Nespresso machine, so Kate can make me a coffee while we're driving. It's the best thing ever.
I am so shocked and amazed to hear that. I can't believe it.
I know.
Is my deadpan coming through?
The evolution of Joe's coffee journey.
Yes, has gotten to Nespresso.
Please tell me you did not hook it up to your Berkey.
Of course.
You need a trailer just for that setup. Gosh.
It's really going to be Joe's motorcycle and coffee trailer that we're towing behind. Uh-huh.
But going back to the small towable toy haulers, now we're still talking MSRP, but I'm actually surprised at how much they're charging for those.
Specifically in tech, yes, they're more expensive, but that is a generational camper that you would be getting. Those things are juggernauts. Man, if you could swing the bill, it's an awesome unit to have for sure. So, Kate, to circle back to one of your other questions about some of the trends, we mentioned overlanding. I have another trend I'd like to bring up, and that is, it seems like a lot of the mainstream RV manufacturers are coming out with what we're calling a new entry-level vehicle. There's a few examples. The Winnebago Access, which is a conventional build, which has the wooden framework with the corrugated siding. Some of the others following that same suit would be Cruiser has the Avenir. I'm drawing a blank on some others, but it seemed like there was a good half a dozen or so new brands that were quote-unquote entry-level. How do they achieve that entry-level price? A lot of times it's called decontenting, where they won't include a TV or they won't include an oven, things like that. They certainly wouldn't include the premium materials like a solid surface countertop. Instead, they'll go with more like a thermal foil wrapped plywood. That was the other by far the other trend that we saw. It's actually another story that we're working on for a later issue of the magazine. And that's really coming from dealer feedback. The dealers always would prefer to have a lower price point so that they could sell more, of course. And what happened was, it's just like everything else, the price creep. The brands that have been around for a long time, you keep putting bells and whistles in them. Well, those add up. That cost quickly escalates so that it's no longer entry level. So instead of decontenting those, they just come out with a new brand and call that their entry level.
Going away from the RV for a little bit, I was reading the Dirt Report that you all had posted a summary of, and they were talking about how people are finding it harder and harder to get into a campground or booking a campsite. Have you all noticed any industry side trends with campgrounds? Like, are there more campgrounds being developed, more campsites becoming available to kind of handle the demand?
Yeah, there are. That's the short answer. The long answer is there are, but they're not coming fast enough. The demand is still way, way outweighing or outpacing the availability. Just personally speaking, I mean, we live in Michigan. We prefer state parks, so that's typically what we will try and reserve. In Michigan, it's a 6-month window. You can't reserve, more than 6 months out. And in Michigan, it's actually even a little more difficult this year because it seems like a good third of our state park campgrounds are getting renovated to one degree or another. So they'll either close for the first half of the summer or all summer long. So it's even more scarce to try and find a campsite. We have a story coming out not too long ago, or that came out not too long ago, on the influx of big corporate money into the campground sector. And a lot of it's coming from the hotel side. They're realizing that there's money to be had. I mean, they all see the same numbers, 1.2 million RV owners just in the last 2 years, to go with the 9 million who owned an RV before that. The good news is they're coming in, they're bringing some money, they're gonna upgrade some campsite or campgrounds that are already out there. The bad news is those prices are going to go up because of that big money coming in. Quite frankly, one reason why we prefer state park campgrounds is it's less expensive. And for our type of camping, we don't need the water park and we don't need the jump pad. We just need a good campfire and some privacy.
Yeah, we haven't done campgrounds very much over the last 8 years that we've been RVing. And just from what I've heard and seen, the prices of campgrounds have skyrocketed. And a lot of point to where, I remember a few years back, if it was $50 a night, that was considered very expensive. Now agreed. $100 is getting more along the norms for some of these places.
Yep, agreed. The funny thing is, and maybe it's not funny so much as just ironic, is, I mean, I'm trying to book hotels right now for the Florida RV Super Show, and you can't touch one for under $300 a night. So yeah, the campgrounds are now $100 a night, and that's crazy. Who would have ever thought of that? Well, that Motel 6 is no longer $68 a night. It's $300 and up.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons why when we go down to Disney World, we love camping at Fort Wilderness.
Sure.
I mean, I think this last time we paid how much a night?
$97 a night.
Okay, so $100 a night. Well, that's for the two of us, our van. We could have up to 10 people and park at least two vehicles. So if we had a friend with a van, we could split the price with them. And you look at any of the Disney hotels, you're talking about $300, $400, $500, $600 a night.
Right, right. And you're not eating your own food.
Nope.
You're not using your own bed or sleeping in your own bed or your own bathroom. All of the benefits of RVing that we're all very familiar with and prefer.
Now, if you did have a crystal ball.
Oh, okay.
Looking beyond 2024, how do you see the industry shaking out, particularly in terms of EV, electric vehicles?
Oh, man, that's a $1 million question right there as far as EV, because just within the last week or two, seeing the news reports about how the EV market isn't all what it was cracked up to be. And so it's almost like a fine line. I'm talking to the RV makers. They still have to continue down that path. They have to commit some R&D money to making sure that they have an EV product of some sort for those people who want one. Okay. But my God, it's expensive to come up with those things. What was the one? Ford just, it was either Ford or GM just talked about how they lost billions of dollars just trying to come up with some sort of EV program that the market's not ready to embrace just yet.
No.
That's for people making a lot more money than we do. That's their decisions to have to contend with, right?
Well, the thing I found interesting was when we were at the Florida RV show this past year and Winnebago had their EV concept there. Mm-hmm. It's a great looking unit, a lot of cool features, and I love what they've done with it. But then you find out the range and, you know, that van empty with no build out and a full charge will get you a little over 100 miles. And it's just like, it's not practical yet unless you're camping within the area in which you live. But the thing I'm really interested in are the electric towables, where they have a energy assist feature to help push the vehicle along. And now not only do you have an EV kind of vehicle, you're getting better gas mileage from your towed or your tow vehicle. But you don't have to worry about necessarily if it runs out of charge, it runs out of charge and you can keep going. So I see that being a bigger part of the industry. I don't know what you've seen.
Seen a few of those EV chassis, towable chassis, in their development phase. I haven't seen too many in beyond the R&D phase. Lippert is the one that comes to mind right off the top of my head, but there's others out there working on the same, somewhat similar system. You're right. And to add to what you mentioned, the other thing that those chassis have are the regenerative energy components. Something inside the axle that when it's spinning around, it's gonna create energy and help, like you said, push the tow vehicle, or even charge back and forth if you happen to have an EV tow vehicle, right? It's exciting. It's gonna happen. It's just how much money are they gonna be willing to invest in it for a market that they don't really know when it's gonna become full effect that will want what they're producing. Like I said, bigger decisions by bigger people than me.
Yeah. I would say the biggest misconception, though, that I've seen of the EV industry has been the consumer side, the thought that all you have to do is add some solar panels to it. So when you're out camping, it'll charge up. And until you've RV'd enough and you understand an RV's electrical system and how much energy solar can actually put in and how much energy a electric motor on a vehicle takes, you quickly realize how, you know, solar and battery have to go a long way before that's even remotely possible.
Some of the other downsides to especially an EV RV or an ERV, Even if it's a 200 mile range or 500 mile range, how long does it take to plug that in to charge it up? So if you're not at your campsite where you can charge it up overnight or while you're there for the duration, it's not like a gas station where you're in and out in 15 minutes. And that's if nobody else is in at the EV charger in front of you. There's a whole bunch of logistics that still have to play out.
Well, I think there's also going to be a bit of a culture change because you look at, let's say you have an EV camper. You roll into the campground, and while most people are plugging into a 30 or 50 amp plug so they can run their AC and, you know, everything else in the camper, you're plugging in so you can charge your camper back up.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot more energy. And I'm willing to bet once kind of the ERVs start to hit the market in more saturation, RV parks are either not going to allow them or you're going to get a special surcharge because of the amount of electricity you're using.
We actually had a news report just last week, on a campground not allowing somebody to plug in their EV at their campground or their campsite pedestal for that very reason. What you're going to see more now too is the campsite pedestals will have meters on them. So you will be charged for the amount of power that you use. It won't be that, you know, $35 a night. It'll be, you'll get a bill at the end of your stay. You used X amount of power, and then this is the charge for that X amount of power that you used. So they were headed that way anyway. I'm talking about the campgrounds. They were headed that way anyways, because, and we're just as guilty as anybody else, leaving your air conditioner on, even if you're not inside your RV, you're out, you know, hiking a trail. Well, that's using power that's not necessary. So the campgrounds were responding by putting in the metered pedestals. If EVs really take off, that's, you're going to see a lot more of those coming out too, for sure.
I believe it. And one thing I have not seen here in the U.S., and maybe you have, was when we were in Italy, there were self-service campgrounds that would have a gate that you would roll up to. You would get a QR code or some type of thing from them. You would check in, find your camp spot, and usually it was unassigned, so you just grabbed an open one, and you stayed for as long as you wanted to, and then they charged you when you went out. And it was all done remotely. It was available 24/7. And it was just a very easy, convenient way to do it. And I haven't seen that here yet, but I feel like that should be coming to the U.S.
It's probably closer than what you realize, only because a lot of the campground suppliers, especially the ones that come up, are coming out with these metered pedestals, are also coming out with these gated entry points with the access cards and whatnot. More so to keep unwanted guests from coming in than for any other reason. But boy, that seems like the next step. If you're going to, punch a code to get in and then punch a code when you're done, that's your length of stay. There's your charge. Yeah.
There's more of an argument for having a big battery bank and not having to plug in.
And charge while you're driving.
Yeah, exactly. I would love to have you back on the podcast. I think specifically to delve more into the price of RVs.
Sure.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions there, some misunderstandings, and some advice that we can help people on. But before we let you go, there's a question that we're going to be asking all of our guests on this show. I'll let Kate introduce the question.
The question is, what is something you wish you had known about RVing before you got into it?
Man, that's a good one. Put me on the spot. Probably the use. Okay, this is a cop-out answer, but the use of checklists. Okay. The first year that we, I'm still making mistakes of forgetting things at home or forgetting to do this particular maintenance check item off the checklist. I mentioned our first camper was a hybrid. The very first trip we went out, I was so excited. I went right to our campsite, forgot to fill up with water. And by the time we were set up, you know, that it's a hybrid, so it takes a little bit of time. I didn't want to go break it down and then go back to the dump station and get water. So I lugged this 5-gallon bucket back and forth. I don't know. I forget what our capacity was. I think it was might have been 55 gallons or something like that. So whatever, you know, 10 trips to fill up with water.
I think we can relate to the checklists, because I mentioned a story in our very first podcast about how when we took the dogs for their first ride, we didn't think to go through the RV and close all the drawers and everything. And a minute from the house, it turned into a giant disaster where all the drawers are flying open, the dogs are jumping in my lap. And it was at that moment we were like, we need to put together a checklist.
Yes.
And we even have one now for the house. Like when we're leaving, we have a checklist. We go through, make sure everything is done. We've learned our lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rick, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Again, we would love to have you back at some point.
And if people want to get in touch with you, how can they find you?
Well, very simple answer is just go to rvbusiness.com or woodallscm.com. Both of those websites will have further contact information. People can subscribe to our magazines for free. It's not only the print magazines, but also our digital news feed that we put out every day, 5 days a week, excuse me. And you can stay up with the RV and the campground industry that way as well.
They are great magazines, and I'm kind of biased because I'm a writer for them, but hey.
We're biased a little bit too, but Joe, you and Kate make our magazine and our community all that better. I appreciate
it.
Thank you for having me on too. This is fun.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of RVing with Joe and Kate. For resources that we mentioned in today's episode, head on down to the show notes or our website, wertherussos.com. While you're there, sign up for our newsletter to receive updates, tips and tricks, and many other things about the RVing lifestyle. If you haven't already, please subscribe, and we will see you next time. Thank you so much for listening or watching. Bye.